presentation is Jewish Voice for Peace Health and Human Rights Project. This is a report from our fifth delegation. To Israel and Palestine. It's a two-week delegation. We just returned this past Saturday. Jewish Voice for Peace, and those are our websites, and you can Google us, is a national membership organization that supports the aspirations of Israelis and Palestinians for security and self-determination. JVP seeks an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, a resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem consistent with international law and equity, an end to all violence against civilians, and a change in U.S. foreign policy consistent with these principles. JVP's Health and Human Rights Project brings health professionals and others interested in human rights to Israel and Palestine to work with their counterparts in the health sector and in the peace movement on both sides. We document conditions on the ground and disseminate this information to inform the public debate and to contribute to policy change in the U.S. We partner primarily with Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. I'm going to give you some observations from the October 2007 delegation. Again, we've just completed that group, that delegation. I'm going to talk primarily about the West Bank because our delegation this year did not visit Gaza, and we'll break these into three parts: observations related to travel restrictions and access problems, related to the territorial expansion of Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, and finally, violence against civilians. I'm going to just give you some of the context. Dima Kato already outlined much of this material, so I'm going to step through it fairly quickly, and I'm taking it from the same source as did Ms. Kato, which is this document from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, and I would encourage any of you who would like to get more detailed and current information to go to the OCHA website. It's excellent. They have people all over the ground in the territories. It's OCHA, OPT.org. This is their July 2007 report. This report summarizes that 40% of the West Bank is now taken up by Israeli infrastructure. Roads linking settlements to Israel in conjunction with an extensive system of checkpoints and roadblocks have fragmented Palestinian communities from each other. As we've seen in the second presentation, you've seen all some of this information already, but this is a map that shows you the location of settlement colonies and outposts. Of note, settlement activity in terms of the total number of settlers has gone up by 63% since the beginning of the Oslo period in 1993. So starting in 93 at under 200,000, there are now well over 400,000 settlers in the occupied territories. There are closed military and free fire zones represented by the red here, which further serve to take productive land out of Palestinian hands and segment communities one from another. Then there is the barrier, as described by Ms. Kato, the West Bank wall, it's called by some. It's called a separation or a security barrier or a security fence by the Israelis. It's also been called by many an apartheid wall or a annexation wall. It's important to note that three-quarters of this barrier actually lies within the West Bank. Only about one-quarter actually coincides with the Green Line, which was the Armistice Line of 1949. 10%, when the barrier is completed, it will include 10% of the West Bank on the Israeli side, creating a so-called seam zone in which there will be an estimated 50,000 Palestinians now cut off from the rest of the West Bank, and to the west, to the east rather, and the Green Line to the west. And these areas, it's also important to note, include some of the richest agricultural lands and some of the largest water resources, and specifically the mountain aquifer, which lies right here. So these are, this has been said by many, including the International Court of Justice, to represent not a security barrier so much as an annexation of resources. Then there are the settlers-only roads, 20 major and regional roads connecting the settlements to each other and to Jerusalem, further segmenting the territory since these roads can't be crossed by Palestinians living in the region. And then there is the barrier regime, which again, OCHA, the UN, has divided into these categories of checkpoints, partial checkpoints, road gates, earth mounds, road barriers, earth walls, road blocks, and trenches. 85 of these are manned, woman or person, however you like to put it, by the military. The rest are passive obstructions that people have to get around. As of the middle of July, there was a grand total, according to OCHA's calculation, of 539 of these obstacles to movement. And again, it's worth noting that despite stated intentions of the Israeli government to the contrary, there really has been no reduction in the total number of these obstacles since the Gaza disengagement, so-called, 2 years ago. In fact, they've increased since then. If you look at these all together, you can see, again, as was described in Ms. Cato, how the West Bank has been carved into isolated stands of Palestinian population, has been referred by some as the Bantu stands created within the West Bank. This has certainly created an obstacle for access to health care. Again, this is from the OCHA report. Palestinians rely on hospitals in East Jerusalem for routine emergency and specialist treatment. They need to get a permit to reach a hospital. There's difficulties in traveling to East Jerusalem because of the barrier and checkpoints. In addition to the general unpredictability of access for patients, has led to a 50% drop in patient admissions in these hospitals. The number of outpatients also fell by more than half between 2002 and 2003 and continues to drop. Medical staff from the West Bank also face difficulties getting to work. 70% are West Bankers and require permits. Now, I'm going to show you an example that I became aware of when I was seeing patients last week in a medical relief clinic in Sinjil Village, which is northeast of Ramallah. This boy is named Muhammad Khalil. He's 12 years old, but because he suffered severe birth asphyxia, cerebral anoxia, he now weighs about 24 kilos. He's blind. He's profoundly retarded, all as a consequence of birth anoxia. His mother, shown here, is named Fainan Saeed Khalil, and she presented the history that she had arrived at the Calandia checkpoint in labor with her fourth child and was forbidden to pass. She spent 5 hours laboring at the checkpoint and finally delivered her newborn, who was covered with meconium. He aspirated meconium, became cyanotic. When I asked her to describe this, she pointed to the blue color of a calendar that was on the desk in the room. It took 2 hours for an ambulance to reach him and evacuate him to Augusta Victoria Hospital, where he was resuscitated, but left with this profound cerebral palsy, mental retardation. This mother spends most of her total time, caring for him. Her husband has a salary of $320 a month working for the Palestinian Authority. They spend about two-thirds of it, she reported, caring for this child. She carries him everywhere she goes. She can't afford the specialized chair she would need for him, and she has chronic back pain as a result. Moving on to describe some observations about territorial expansion in the territories, we visited a community of villages around Tawani Village in the southern West Bank in the Hebron Hills area. This is a pretty poor community. They're traditionally shepherds. They herd sheep and have some grain crops and some olive harvesting, farming as well. And they described to us that their income and their living situation was relatively stable and productive until the arrival of this settlement, Ma'on, about 20 years ago on this neighboring hilltop. And since then, life has become very difficult for them. The roads connecting this settlement to other settlements have cut up their land so that they can no longer reach all their grazing land or all their cropland. The settlers have been very aggressive, have attacked the shepherds, have attacked their children on the way to school. The community and its community building has this little display of photographs of some of the confrontations, including this photograph, which shows poison material that was laid across the land by the settlers to poison their sheep. They succeeded in killing about 100 sheep. This photograph here is of a stand of olive trees that was hacked down by the settlers some years ago. It started to grow back. the internationals have since come to try to protect the settlers, I mean, the excuse me, the villagers from these aggressive actions of the settlers. Moving finally to violence against civilians, just to update you about the last year, at least through the end of August, which is the most recent data that the United Nations has made public. You can see that the Palestinian death toll continues, 230 Palestinian deaths through the end of August of this year, two deaths on the Israeli side, and as you can see from the middle bars, a substantial proportion of these Palestinian deaths are in children aged under 18. This is Dr. Khalid Saleh, who is the director of Rafidia Hospital, which we visited. It's a 165-bed surgical hospital run by the Palestinian Authority in Nablus. He told us that since the beginning of the Second Intifada in September of 2000, about 12,000 patients, injured patients, had been treated at his hospital. He estimated that 40 to 50% of these patients were children under age 18 years, and that between 70 and 80% were civilians. Many of these patients had been used as human shields by the Israeli military. Many were left with permanent disabilities. He told us about two recent incidents where the hospital's ambulances were prevented from reaching wounded patients with subsequent loss of life. While we were in Nablus, we were taken to this house. 2 days before our arrival, this house had been attacked by the Israeli military. There are 20 people living there in this building on several levels. They're all members of the Sabeach family. I may be pronouncing that incorrectly. This is Mahmoud Sabeach on the left, and he described to us what had happened. I'll quote him as I transcribe the translation. And again, this happened 2 days before our arrival in Nablus, which was last, which was 2 weeks ago on Sunday. At about 2 a.m., Israeli soldiers began surrounding the building and throwing concussion grenades. They shouted to leave the building, but we were not sure which building they meant. After 20 minutes, the shooting started from all directions. Windows were shot out. I started shouting, "Why are you shooting? We have children in here." I came out with my wife, our hands up. We were forced to take off our clothes. They told us there was shooting coming from our building, and we told them it was only our family in the building and no one was shooting. The soldiers asked who lived on each floor, then forced me to go into the house as a human shield, made me knock on the doors. Two Israeli soldiers disagreed with each other about this. During this action, a 71-year-old man on the living on the first floor was killed when he opened his door and was shot and shot and died. We went around the house. The family was all there, and as you can see, this is mostly a household of women and children, and as is common throughout Palestine, people tend to live in large buildings with different family units, all members of the same extended family, which was the case here. It was pretty clear to us that this place had been pretty badly shot up. There were bullet holes in all the rooms. Bullets had flown in through the windows. These are bedrooms of the family. These are bullet holes through the bed where children had been sleeping before they were roused and gathered together by their parents. This is a sweater, one of the little girls. She was not in it, thankfully. You can see the bullet holes through this curtain as bullets poured into this room and lodged in the ceiling and the walls. The family had collected some of the spent ammunition, including this rocket, which probably was paid for by the tax dollars of those of us who are U.S. citizens and taxpayers. This is where the rocket hit and blew a hole out of the ceiling. Our psychiatrist, Marcia Zuckerman, went back to Nablus 2 days afterwards and saw three of the families, three of the mothers living in this building, and interviewed them at the Palestinian Medical Relief Clinic in Nablus. And I'm going to quote her her notes from those interviews. Three of the mothers came to the clinic and I saw them sequentially. All three had their own anxiety symptoms and reported on the anxiety of their children. All three children, 2, 3, and 10 years old, had been fully toilet trained and were now wetting their beds at night. All three were sleeping with parents and siblings. The first mother brought her 3-year-old daughter, who didn't say a word to me or her mother. She kept her eyes fixed on me throughout the interview in a frightened expression and did not respond either to the antics of a stuffed animal or the availability of colored markers, which both her mother and I demonstrated to her. The second mother brought her two-year-old daughter, who was bouncing off the walls. She complained that her daughter insisted on being carried everywhere and clung to her throughout the day. She awakened overnight crying inconsolably and could not be comforted by either parent for nearly 2 hours. The mother wouldn't stay at home alone, going to her mother's when her husband was out. When she awakened in the middle of the night to heat milk for her daughter or to use the toilet, she awakened her husband and told him to come with her. The third mother struggled with intrusive memories of the attack, particularly the explosive device that had landed in their apartment. Her 10-year-old son was also wetting the bed. I'll conclude with some observations by Professor Rita Jockeman, with whom we met in Ramallah. Professor Jockeman heads the Division of Community Medicine at Beer Zeit University. This is a study that was published this year in Public Health. It was a survey of 3,415 10th and 11th grade students in the Ramallah district. They were asking the question whether humiliation as a measurable phenomenon during situations of conflict such as this might be independently associated with adverse health outcomes. So they used survey questions derived from the WHO, from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program and focus groups, and what they found was a dose response effect seen with psychological and somatic symptoms increasing with increasing numbers of forms of humiliation experienced. These data are from a controlled multiple regression analysis which isolated humiliation as a factor, and it turns out that there is a dose response effect between the number of types of humiliation experienced. For example, if you yourself had been humiliated by Israeli military, if you had witnessed a family member being humiliated or a stranger being humiliated, the number of symptoms rose steeply independently with these different quantified measures of humiliation, which just suggests that the damage that's being done and continues to be done to the Palestinians living in the occupied territories goes beyond the usual body counts and injury reports that we think of, and has to be broadened to include such measures as the psychological effects of humiliation that's experienced really on a daily basis by the people living in the territories. And I'll conclude it there. We have a lot of time left for discussion, and I would appreciate it if people would identify themselves, would identify to whom, which of the panelists you would like to address your question, if any, and finally to limit yourself. This is a highly charged area. I think it would be fair to everyone to please limit your comments and make a comment or a question, but not a speech. And I'm going to make a time limit of, say, 2 minutes, and I'm going to sort of try to hold everyone to it. So, Dr. Gadelovich, would you like to come up here and, yeah, let's maybe back there. Thank you. let's allow Dr. Gudelovich to respond.
Well, unfortunately, my English is not as fluent as the question, so I cannot phrase it so eloquently. But I am working at the hospital. I have no idea if they are screened for whatever reason. Maybe they are screened, and it wouldn't surprise me. But what I do know for a fact that if there is a screen, that this screen allows violence. Victims of Palestinians. This screen allows for terrorists, actually terrorists who were caught in terrorist attacks, and therefore it's difficult for me to say, because I'm not with the screening procedures. I'm working in the hospital, what I showed is the fact that I have written down from the hospital records, and these were the diagnosis. These were the patients who were treated. These are facts. There are probably a lot more. I know that there are a lot more patients that are transferred to the Tel Aviv hospitals from Gaza, and because in our hospital we don't have advanced cardiologic or neurosurgery or neurological care. And our hospital receives a minority of these patients. I have no idea about what you ask, but maybe there is a screen. There can be. If there is, then it's not a very effective one. No, I have no idea, but I don't expect 441 people to be intelligent sources. I think this is a little bit far-fetched, what you're saying.
I just want to make a comment. I was also surprised by Dr. Gudelovich's report that people had to be protected if they went to Israel to seek medical attention, because I can't speak for Gaza. We didn't go to Gaza this time, although I was there 3 years ago. But we met many, many families who were, in fact, treated in Israeli children, who were treated in Israeli hospitals. And when someone goes, it's a big deal, and the whole community knows about it, and no one seemed to be shy about reporting that. So at least in the West Bank, I can't say that I saw any evidence of people being hesitant to identify themselves as having been treated in Israeli hospitals. Quite the contrary. In fact, they wanted to go to Israeli hospitals because they know the care is good there, because Palestinian hospitals are under tremendous stress. They're funded by the Palestinian Authority. I'll make one other just factual observation about this question, because it is on the table. I did not include this in my presentation, but this postcard, which I'm holding here, I'm sorry I can't project it, shows a young man with an amputated leg and a bloody remaining leg. This is distributed by Physicians for Human Rights Israel, because they have been working very hard on exactly what you identify, that patients are not being evacuated, who need treatment and who can't get it in Gaza. The translation, this card is in Hebrew, the translation reads, I'll read this to you because it's of interest. I wonder what would be going through the mind of a GSS officer, meaning Israeli military, or a soldier when he decides that a young amputee who is about to lose his other leg constitutes a security threat and so sentences him to a life of suffering and pain. This picture is of Alaa Odeh, age 25, who was shot in the legs in June 2007. By the way, he is a Fatah member, and he was shot by Hamas supporters. The state, supported by the High Court of Justice, refused to grant him passage into Israel for the necessary treatment. In the absence of appropriate care in Gaza, his doctors were obliged to amputate one of his legs. Shortly after this photograph was taken, his other leg was also amputated. And the reason that PHR is trying to publicize this case is that in June 07, during the proceedings of a petition submitted to the High Court of Justice regarding exit of the sick and wounded from Gaza, the state claimed that Israel bears no legal responsibility towards the inhabitants of Gaza, and that the passage of the sick and wounded would be enabled as a humanitarian gesture only. For the first time, the state has made a quasi-medical distinction between danger to life and danger to, quote, quality of life, i.e. loss of a limb, and stated that entry will be permitted only in life-threatening cases. In practice, this means that patients in danger of losing a limb will not be considered to be in a condition necessitating passage to medical centers in Israel. PHR Israel's medical ethicists have determined that this distinction has no medical justification, since the reason is not a lack of appropriate medical resources. Accordingly, from a medical ethics perspective, a doctor is not permitted to assist in making such a distinction, which denies patients access to appropriate care. The state, for its part, has no right to oblige doctors to participate in medical classification subject to this unjustified criteria. I just wanted to put that out. Next. Everyone hear the comment. It was addressed to me, and it was that the questioner feels that I didn't address sufficiently the whole picture or the complexity or perhaps the context in which I reported the facts on the ground. In fact, that was not my intention. We don't have the time or this is not the time or the place to discuss the entire history of the Mideast conflict. I mean, that would be an impossible project for us. We look at certain aspects. The aspect that I chose for this presentation was, how does it look now in the West Bank? What does it look like on the ground? That's our starting point. I would hope that people would come and take from this presentation the question, why is it that way? Must it be that way? Those were not the questions that I chose to address. In 15 minutes, I think the most important thing is to lay out to people, what does it look like on the ground? On this, if you're looking for a broader context, I would recommend people go see the movie about Jimmy Carter, which I saw last night. It's currently playing. And what Jimmy Carter says to his audiences who challenge him with similar kinds of questions is, you know, you should go to the West Bank and look. Go and look for yourself what's happening there, and then ask yourself, is there a reason for this? And what is the reason for this? My short answer is, it's territorial expansion. We can discuss that further, perhaps at the end, but I would like to give other people a chance to have to join in the discussion. Yes. I'd just like to repeat that. I think your observation was that Dr. Gadelovich reported on 400 and some patients, and it's a 500-bed facility. Sorry, over 2 years, over 3 years, and that speaks to the inadequacy of the coverage, essentially, for population, a needy population in Gaza. Is that a summary of the question?
Well, that's the amount of patients that were admitted to our hospital. Overall from Gaza, I don't know how many came for treatment to Israel. Like I said, our hospital receives the minority of those who come for treatment. because they are bigger and more advanced hospitals with more advanced facilities, especially in Tel Aviv area, that receive much more Palestinian patients from Gaza. So the number is just, this is the descriptive epidemiology that I have shown, nothing more. This is not an analysis of rates.
Who is it targeted to serve? So the hospital was constructed to serve whom in that area? Because when I looked at the hospital, if you look at the surrounding areas, I thought I saw settlements, which shouldn't be there. So is it, I mean, who's the target patient population for the hospital?
Well, I probably didn't explain adequately, but this is an Israeli regional hospital that that is intended to treat the Israeli population of Ashdod, Ashkelon, and a few other towns in the neighborhood, overall about population of about 400,000 within Israel. The hospital was not built for the purposes of anything else. The Palestinians who wish to be treated there and come for treatment to this hospital will never be denied. But this is obviously a minority of patients. I'm sorry to say, you are saying that I didn't say the truth, but well, you are invited to come and count for yourself.
I've
been asked several times for, I was told stories, you are telling another unfortunate story, I have no idea how true that is. Dr. Myers have shown us stories of people and shown pictures of people who told them stories of other people who have been injured, and I believe they are probably true. But however, I have no idea, possibility to evaluate these stories. I know what I have presented, and this is something that can be counted again and can be checked, and there is no problem at all with that. What I'm saying is that the people who come to the hospital are treated and will be treated. Until the moment that they arrive in the emergency room, I have no idea, I really don't, because I'm not within this sector, what they undergo. And they probably do undergo difficulties, and they probably do have problems for coming from the Hamas-governed area to Israeli hospital. This is probably not easy. I believe that this is a real challenge. And it's not that's not a question. It's obviously this is difficult.
Thank you.
So I don't know if people heard the comment. I think it was a comment, not a question, that was suggested that this represents a form of genocide. I would just like to maybe make one-line response, which I think the term which has been used by the Israeli historian Ilan Pappe in a book published last year is ethnic cleansing. And really, if you're attend to the human rights literature, he actually defines that term in some specific detail. And I believe that in a human rights context, that ethnic cleansing would be the term that would most aptly apply to the situation from 48 forward and continuing today. Yes.
In terms of the Palestinian perception of what the responsibility of their governments are, I first have to say that I don't live in Palestine, so I can't really speak entirely on their behalf. But I want to clarify that you can't really assume that Palestinians have a government. And if they do, in theory, it's not politically effective in a way that the population should assume any responsibility for their government. Palestine is still under occupation. The ultimate authority is within the Israeli government as an occupying power. So if anything, the Palestinians should expect Israel as the government in power to resume responsibility for any health or healthcare services for them. While, yes, true, okay, Hamas has maybe some civil control over the West Bank, it's for practical political purposes ineffective. In Gaza, Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza. They're just there. And they're ultimately under the control of Israel. So, you know, you might have some people that would expect health or any kind of civil services to be undertaken by their governments, but in the case of Palestine, that is not something that I think it should be expected.
Well, I must say that this question I can only answer with another question. if I think that there is a screening procedure that is unjustified and bad, shall I deny the treatment of those who do arrive at my door? That's the answer to that question is very clear to me, which is no. I will never deny the treatment, and the hospital will always continue to treat those who arrive at its emergency room. So that's the answer, I think, for what you ask. I would like to post a question by myself for Dr. Myers, because first I would like to compliment him, because I think that for a Jewish American to go to the Palestinian Authority, it shows an enormous amount of bravery. And I would like to ask, you said that we can Google the Jewish Voice for Peace, and I did. And I did find the site, and I did find other sites of Israeli movement of what is called Peace Now, and the Voice of Peace station that was bankrupt, but it's still on the Google. I did not find, and I specifically tried to look for the Palestinian Voice for Peace organization, and I would like if you can refer us to their site or connection.
I'm not aware of a group that shares our name, but Jewish Voice for Peace maintains active connections and collaboration with peace organizations within Israel, as Dr. Gudelevich mentioned. Physicians for Human Rights Israel is one. There are many others. We met with a group called Combatants for Peace, which is pairing Israeli and Palestinian former combatants who are now turning to nonviolence as a way to move forward together. There's a group called Ta'ayush, which consists of both Jewish and Palestinian Israelis who are trying to seek nonviolent means to peaceful change. Machzom Watch, which is a group of mostly middle-aged Jewish mothers and grandmothers who go every day to the checkpoint to watch for violations of human rights at the checkpoints, and others. There's Courage to Refuse, Yesh Gavul, which consists of Israeli military who refuse to serve in the occupied territories. People should understand there, it may be small in relation to the entire Israeli population, but the Israeli peace movement is very active and very courageous, and I thank Dr. Gudelevich for the compliment, but frankly, we have found that it doesn't really, it doesn't represent any personal threat to us to visit the territories, unless there were shooting going on. But we were warmly welcomed everywhere we went. Even when we identified ourselves as a Jewish group, typically what would happen is the conversation might pause a little, and people would take it in and be a little surprised, and then say thank you, and the conversation would go right on. So. Again, I encourage people to visit. There are many ways to do it. On the Palestinian side, the structures that we are familiar with reside within the non-governmental organization sector, the NGO sector, and two that you could go to would be the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees. You can Google those. One is PARC, Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees, and one is Palestinian Medical Relief Society, UPMRC. Both of these organizations, which are large, they're the largest in their sectors in the NGO world, advocate peaceful change. And in fact, they do activities on the ground to promote peaceful change. For example, there are training sessions that PARC engages in with its workers in nonviolent action. Palestinian Medical Relief maintains youth centers that teach nonviolent methods, that teach the history of democracy, English language, and computer skills as well. It's not well known to the outside world because there is, in effect, an information blockade, certainly in the mass media in the United States, that Palestinian civil society has taken a big shift and a big step and an active step towards nonviolence. So I would encourage people to look at those sites, and I think it's a good question. It's where is the site for peace? Well, you have to look You have to look at Palestinian society at large and not so much at its governmental representations. Yes, in the back? Did everyone hear the comment? I'm not sure I could summarize it. I just want to respond that, as opposed to taking sides, I myself personally in this presentation and Jewish Voice for Peace in general says nothing that the Israeli peace movement does not say. We're against violence against all civilians anywhere, including within Israel. And I'm personally aware of this. I would be afraid myself. I'd be afraid to put a child on a bus. Especially during a period when bombings were more common, and that might return, and that would be a terrible thing, in my view and in our view. Our view is that this will not stop until peace is achieved, and that peace will not be achieved until the occupation ends. That is, I can say, from our organization, that's our bottom line. Yes, over there. Thank you.
like to apologize for my cold, and I can't really protect my voice very well, but I think kind of reiterating what you said, I mean, it's true, you have to appreciate efforts by Israelis to improve the health of Palestinians, their obligation. So it's not it's great, but it's also their obligation, one. And two, these are temporary solutions. And while they may affect acute health of Palestinians, and you know, probably in terms of genetic screening long term, they're not solutions to the problem. I mean, not to criticize you, your comment is well taken. Oh, I know, I understand. I mean, I just kind of use that as a reference point for the point that it's a process, and the outcome is that occupation has to end for anything in between and peace to be realized now and in the future. And for occupation and all its implications, including annexation, housing demolitions, closures, curfews, everything has to end. Otherwise, peace, unfortunately, is far from achievable.